I next met with Dr. Charles Blanke, and of course, regardless of the program, this means I had to touch base with him for just a minute about his continued and fascinating experience with GIST. And if you go to the bonus audio section of ResearchToPractice.com, you'll hear Dr. Blanke's research year in review about GIST. But to begin our conversation about colorectal cancer, I asked Dr. Blanke to summarize the key research data sets that came out over the last year that have a direct impact on medical oncology practice.
Aside from KRAS, in general, I think it was a pretty disappointing year. We didn't see the emergence of any blockbuster new drugs, and we didn't necessarily learn how to use our existing drugs better. I think the single biggest thing that I would care about as a practitioner treating this is the emerging data on double antibody therapy. And what I mean by that is we have antibodies against VEGF that work quite well, bevacizumab, of course, and we have antibodies against the epidermal growth factor receptor, panitumumab and cetuximab, that work quite well. Data from Len Saltz early on strongly suggested that combining the two antibodies would be the bee's knees and really be a fabulous thing to do with fabulous progression-free survival. We now have a number of trials suggesting the possibility that it's either useless and in certain patient populations perhaps even harmful. So the one takeaway message is I would most certainly not combine the two antibodies off a trial. And in a corollary, or also answering your question, we were faced with at least two North American intergroup trials that had dual antibody arms. And the question arose, what should we do about this? Is the evidence overwhelming enough that we should just scrap them? Or should we keep going under the assumption that maybe they're different enough? And I can just tell you that different decisions were made with each study. The second line study, 0600, which is a Southwest Oncology Group trial, decided to bag the double antibody arm. And the frontline trial that I'm the PI on decided to keep it. But there was very contentious discussion on both trials.
The frontline being the chemo, bev, chemo, cetuximab, chemo, both?
Exactly right. There was strong discussion of eliminating that last arm. But to be honest, in my opinion, had we done so, then the question would have been over for all eternity without definitively having been answered.
What is your thinking right now in terms of first-line therapy for patients with KRAS wild tumors and in sort of different kinds of situations? How do you think that thing through?
Well, we know that in theory and in practice, the chemotherapies that we have are essentially equivalent in terms of efficacy. So we basically have a full FOX-like regimen or we have a full FOLFIRI-like regimen, and they're absolutely equivalent in terms of efficacy from a number of randomized trials. I make that decision, depending, of course, what country you're talking about, but for the United States, based on toxicity concerns. So if neuropathy is really a big deal, and certainly it is, there are people who either their hobbies or their profession involves very detailed use of their hands, I use FOLFIRI. On the other hand, if I'm particularly more concerned about alopecia, usually not, or perhaps diarrhea, I would still, like 80% of American physicians, still tend to use full FOX. So that's the chemo question. The biologic is a bit more challenging. If they are indeed wild type, we have the best data for bevacizumab, and that remains standard of care, and that's what I would use. Here the experts differ a little bit. Some trials that have used chemotherapy plus bevacizumab have shown an increased response rate with the addition of the biologic, and some have not. On the other hand, most of us believe that if you add an EGFR inhibitor like cetuximab, you do tend to have a higher response rate. So the segment of the population that's important to, for me, is people who might become surgically resectable even in the setting of advanced or metastatic disease. If I want them to downsize, I tend to use the EGFR antibody instead of bevacizumab. It's a very small population, though, and certainly 90% of the time I'm using bev.
What are some of the clinical research questions that you would like to see addressed in trials right now and are being addressed?
Including the ongoing ones?
Mm-hmm.
Well, best biologic is certainly at the forefront. So the same question I just talked to you about, which is the best chemo, has been asked and answered. Now we're doing exactly the same thing on the 80405 trial. Is bev better than cetuximab, equivalent to it? Is there any chance that the two together really are better? And are there certain patient populations, perhaps, that might benefit from one over the other? So that's a paramount question that will be answered. Additionally, in the second line, in my mind, the biggest question is the BEV beyond progression question. There are theoretical reasons why it's a great idea. There are theoretical reasons why it's not a terrible idea, but at least a useless idea. And the data we have is from Axel Grothy and the registry, which is, of course, a retrospective look and is not a clinical trial. The Southwest Oncology Group 0600 trial will sort of address that in that it has a Bev continuation arm, but it's not being compared to the same treatment without the Bev. It's being compared to an EGFR antibody, which is the way the trial actually evolved. It wasn't the original setup. And so it'll just basically say whether Bev, after failure on Bev, is better than cetuximab or not second line. But indirectly, it'll answer that question, and some European trials will hopefully answer the pure Bev beyond question. And then I think in the adjuvant setting, we, of course, are dying to know if bevacizumab works and if it works wonderfully well. And, of course, we are waiting to see if cetuximab or other antibodies against EGFR work as well. And I think those are the biggest questions. And then sort of a more generic question is, what's the next big class of agents? What's the next blockbuster or even useful agent that's going to enter clinical practice?
Any guesses or thoughts?
I myself, and this is my own personal bias, have been unimpressed in general with a lot of the small molecule inhibitors like sunitinib. It's possible in combination with chemotherapy they'll work better. I think the preclinical data for the insulin growth factor receptor agents, at least in late line therapy, is really pretty exciting. But those trials are so nascent that there are no results whatsoever to talk about right now. But if I were really going to follow a class of drugs with interest, it would be that class.
What about VEGF, small molecule inhibitors? I think cediranib is one. Is that right?
Well, there's a number of those. And as you know, there are a number of different targets ranging from the ligand to the receptor. There are agents that bind receptors as a trap, so to speak. The bottom line is it's hard for me to imagine that any of them will be truly outstanding compared to what we currently have. I think that might work. I think that might work as well as bevacizumab. There are also ones that hit more than one target, and there is some crosstalk, say, between the angiogenesis path and the EGFR path, and so some of those are interesting, but none of them is far enough along that I would look with any great interest right this second.
You know, I was thinking maybe I could ask you to think through and maybe pick out a couple patients from your practice that you've taken care of that you think might be interesting to talk about for whatever reason.
So I had two really interesting patients to me lately. One was a relatively young woman, right around 50, but she looked like she was 20, who basically had the recommended screening colonoscopy, no symptoms whatsoever. She was found to have a real tumor, and she went for what they thought would be the most routine surgery, and she wound up having every complication you could possibly have from a surgical nature. She had a wound dehiscence. She had a wound infection. She had problems with her blood transfusion. And so you had the usual question, which is, do you use adjuvant therapy because you wind up being node positive when there's a big delay, more than 3 months? But we still were squeaking in at about 2.5 months.
How many nodes did she have?
Oh, she had 4 nodes, so I really wanted to treat her.
And was she previously healthy?
Totally healthy. This was absolutely unsuspected, and I have no explanation for why she had. I've never seen this many complications in my life in a healthy person.
And so 2.5 months later, was she pretty well back to normal?
No, and so that's the rub. I would have treated her based on the time interval, because 2.5 is still within our arbitrary, I freely admit it, interval of 3 months. The problem is, after she wound up with a wound infection, she wound up with an intra-abdominal infection, and she had multiple pus pockets.
Wow.
And so these were drained, but she still had a bunch of fluid on her CT. And so question number one was, is this gross infection, yes or no? Number two, if it is gross infection and I put her on adjuvant chemotherapy, what's going to happen? I mean, she has already demonstrated she is sensitive to whatever we do to her, and I would really hate to kill her in the adjuvant setting. On the other hand, her chance of recurrence was so high with the colon cancer, I desperately wanted to treat her. And so then we also had the difficulty of, we planned to do a CT, and if the fluid was gone, it would be an easy decision, but if it was still there, to try and tap these pockets and see if they were sterile pockets versus pus. And then the question is, can you just do one representative pocket, or do you have to do all of them? So she caused me a lot of head scratching. And I also, just to make it a little safer, instead of using the standard full Fox regimen I used what I consider to be a Foo Fox-like regimen, where you eliminate the bolus of 5-FU, you lower the dose of leucovorin, and thus your chance of true neutropenia is markedly lower. And I thought her chance of getting into trouble was lower.
So she actually did get treated?
She just got started, and sure enough, she had pretty much every chemo complication in the book after her first cycle as well, except she didn't have neutropenia, but she had all the usual GI stuff.
When she got started, how long was it since the surgery?
It was 3 months and 2 days, so I broke my own rule, but she was close enough, and she was so high risk, I just did it. And plus, it was a little bit delayed in terms of getting the CAT scan for her.
So what happened exactly in terms of the treatment and the complication?
So I gave her this Foo Fox-like regimen, and I'm proud to say that her white count stayed at about 5,000. It didn't budge. But she developed fairly severe cramping and diarrhea, worse than I usually see. She developed mucositis to the point where she couldn't eat. and she developed neuropathy after her first cycle, which I almost never see. It's a very strange phenotype. I don't think she has like a classic DPD deficiency or anything like that. I think she just seems to be sensitive to treatment, if that makes any sense. I can't explain it scientifically, but she makes me nervous.
So you're going forward with cycle two?
I am going forward with dose modifications with cycle two. And she wants to be very aggressive, despite the fact that 3 months ago in 4 days, she thought she was healthy as a horse. And they came very close to killing her in the hospital with the surgery. And while I didn't kill her with the chemotherapy, she became pretty ill as well. And so I'm worried about her.
I mean, do you think it would be out of the range of consideration just give her capecitabine?
You know, we talked about it. The trouble is I think the oxaliplatin is necessary in node-positive patients. Well, necessary is too strong a word. I think it's important.
That's going to give you an extra bump. There's no doubt about it. You'll get something out of capecitabine, at least.
That's absolutely true. And she hasn't had any... She hasn't had life-threatening toxicity yet, so I'm comfortable just making the dose adjustments and seeing what happens. But she was a real challenge, and if she had had the fluid remaining in her abdomen on the CT, I'm not sure what I would have done. I was tempted to just let it go, but she was fairly desperate to get the chemotherapy, and she was probably right in insisting on it.
What are your thoughts about adjuvant therapy for stage 2 disease? Obviously, there's a lot of controversy about it, and you know, it's kind of interesting, too, the difference as we and as a CME group, and also I think as oncologists in general practice, they listen to the colon people, they listen to the breast people, they listen to the lung people, and everybody, there's a little shades of difference in culture and how they approach similar things like adjuvant therapy.
That's absolutely correct.
So what's your take on it?
Well, you yourself know this. So across the board for the average stage 2 patient, I think from the large trials we have, there is a benefit to therapy, and I think it's on the order of 3%. It may be 5%, it may be 2%, but it's probably 3%. And in my experience, most oncologists don't think that's sufficient. However, akin to the breast cancer population, and you've done much of this research yourself, I think patients do think that that is worth it quite a bit of the time. Not always, but quite a bit of the time.
Well, I wonder about the whole thing about are we overselling treatment and all this stuff, but what we have found, and we reported this last year at a poster at ASCO and ASCO GI, is that actually the first part of your statement, in other words, that you think there's a 2 or 3% benefit, actually we found that oncologists in practice are very unclear about whether that exists. Their perception is that the clinical researchers in the field are not clear there's any benefit. And if you actually turn around to the oncologist and say, just assume there's a 2 to 3, but if you knew there was a 2 to 3% benefit, would you treat? And it's like, yes.
Well, that's really interesting because the population, of course, I deal with mostly are the academicians. And to be fair, I think most colon cancer experts agree there's a 3% benefit.
I think so, too. It's funny, if you really pull it out of them, they all say that, but it's just the way it comes across.
No, I totally understand
that. It's weird, you know?
But they, as a group, don't think the 3% is worth
it. Exactly, right. One of the things, I guess, is you never want to be in a situation where either a doctor or a patient looks back after a recurrence occurs and says, geez, why didn't I do something or whatever?
But the converse of that is if you have the very unusual patient who's DPD deficient and they die, and you say, boy, you just killed granny and you were only going to help her 3% of the time, why did you do it? So in my opinion, you can't go based on results.
You know, it's sort of interesting to talk about, but on the other hand, you know, in a way, I kind of more concerned about talking about what else can we do to stop the mortality of the disease.
Yes.
And you know,
it's not that.
Are there or not, you know, it's fine. We can talk about these other things. We should make the correct decisions. We should be ethical in how we practice medicine. Let's shed light on it and talk about it. But I think the other concern is doctors are seeing people die of colorectal cancer all the time. And, you know, when you look out there and say, well, are things going to be different in 5 years or 10 years? When is it that I can stop seeing so many people dying?
Well, when everybody has their colonoscopy, of course.
Yeah.
Not everybody, but that's going to cut down on significant cases.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, is that realistically something, you know, that what's the penetration right now?
I mean, it's a reimbursement issue probably more, and it's an educational effort.
What's the penetration
well?
Of screening colonoscopy?
I don't know the answer to that. It's not as high as I would like. I do know that. But
what about the other patient that you suggested maybe we talk about? It's looked pretty interesting, a patient with a lung lesion.
I had a couple more thoughts on the stage 2. But
Yeah, sure.
So basically that's for stage 2 as a whole.
Right.
The other statement that I'm willing to make is if you have a garden variety stage 2 normal risk patient and you are going to treat them, I think some form of 5-FU, capecitabine or 5-FU, is the treatment of choice, and I don't think that adding the oxaliplatin is justified in that particular patient population. And that's from, of course, the French Degremont data.
Any preference in terms of 5-FU?
I just give them capecitabine.
Yeah, I mean, you would think
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. Yeah. The final thing, though, is now we have experts like Dan Sargent from Mayo coming out and talking about MSI testing,
right,
and that certain populations might actually be harmed by 5-FU, and suggesting that maybe everybody you're going to give the treatment to needs to be tested. I don't agree with that. I think his trial was very interesting, but very small, 47 patients essentially. But the interesting thing is, I do think we're not going to be having this discussion in a couple of years. We have trials that are trying to separate on a molecular basis the patients by risk. And I think we're going to be a heck of a lot smarter in 5 years.
I wonder, you know, we've seen an absolute revolution in how adjuvant therapy is given in breast cancer with the Oncotype DX assay. And I know that group, a lot of the same people are trying to work on the same thing. Mike O'Connell's been very involved with that from the NSABP, trying to look at whether a genomic analysis. I hear about other things like MSI, as
right,
you were talking about. What do you think about what you've seen so far about the genomic approach with the NSABP and sort of where it's heading?
All I can say is we're going to be doing some sort of testing. I don't know what's going to pan out and what's going to be validated in prospective trials. We have been playing with this concept for at least 15 years that I know of, and we're not doing it yet, which is really annoying to all of us. But I think we finally, especially with the KRAS data, showing that there really are populations that benefit from a drug or don't, people finally believe. And so I think that's probably one of the most exciting things happening in colon cancer right now.
Let's go on to your patient with the lung.
My second one was just a bit more of a, well, same thing, management problem, et cetera. So I was, of course, preparing his records before I saw him, and he, again, looked like a fairly standard 65-year-old gentleman who had a resection of a node-positive rectal cancer. And complicating our life is, by the time I actually saw him, it was quite apparent that he had perhaps the worst emphysema I have ever seen. He had untreated COPD to the point where he was just puffing away in clinic. And, of course, in reviewing his records, I saw that he had a preoperative chest x-ray that had a large spiculated mass that, and I don't want to insult the surgeons, but they basically ignored it while they worked up and removed his rectal primary. So now I have a gentleman.
Should he have had neoadjuvant therapy?
Well, that's another issue, too. He probably was high rectal, and that's a whole different debate about whether he would have benefited or not. But even if we're only talking about postoperative therapy, the questions I had now are, here again, somebody node positive who, in theory, you can reduce their mortality with chemotherapy. However, he either has a primary non-small cell, which might actually be treatable or even curable. We got lucky and found it when it seemed to be isolated. But it also could be a rectal or colon cancer met, which is still theoretically curable. But we also have somebody whose COPD is so bad, I think he probably has a high rate of mortality from his COPD. And if we actually find out that, and this is just a pure guess, it's a 40% mortality in 2 years from COPD, is it worth trying to get a few extra bucks out of adjuvant chemotherapy, both in terms of time and toxicity? And again, just compounding it is, which is worse, to have resected node-positive colon or have a small primary non-small cell? And would he even be able to go under a resection because of his bad COPD of a chest mass?
How big was it?
It was 1.2 centimeters, but it was absolutely classic for non-small cell. And statistically, it was probably more likely. Now, remind you, he hadn't had a full CT yet. And so to make the story more interesting, I got a CT. And right next to the lesion, he had a second lesion, which was not as characteristic for non-small cell. So either he has T4 disease, meaning non-small cell metastatic to the same lung, or he's got colorectal cancer metastatic to his lung, or he's got both. And he really was a high rectum, so it's very feasible that he could have a lung lesion in the absence of liver lesions. And then the question is, how hard do I try to go after tissue on both lesions? And does it matter in terms of, you know, it's going to delay my chemotherapy quite substantially to do all this? But again, I don't want to just sit around while a non-small cell grows if it's potentially curable. He was, what, 62, but he looked about 92.
What was his thinking about this and his feelings about it?
And that wasn't, not to insult him in any way, but he was one of those classic whatever you say docs. He had no input whatsoever into his case. He was totally trusting, which is a nice compliment, but not as helpful.
I'm sorry, how old did you say he was? 60?
He was 62. And he just looked older.
Yeah.
But he had one of the heaviest smoking histories I've ever seen.
It sounds like he was functionally compromised.
He was, and that's another interesting question, which is, this wasn't apparent from any of the notes from the surgeons. And how the heck they took him to the OR and put him under anesthesia without noticing and working this up is quite interesting. I did send him to the pulmonologist. Without going into all the numbers, he had unbelievably severe COPD.
How long had he been functioning so poorly?
Probably 6 to 8 months. Good question, in retrospect.
You know, it's interesting. We have so much data on mortality outcomes based on stage and all these different tumors. And I wonder now, of course, we rarely utilize in the adjuvant online model the numbers about coexisting mortality, which we're kind of getting used to.
Yep.
And there's always this thing about how does comorbidity enter in? I wonder whether they're the same kinds of numbers are out there for COPD and heart disease in terms of prognosis.
Right. There are good numbers for how those people in the absence of cancer do.
Right.
So you just have to sort of try and dial them all in together. But in my mind, as you just hinted at yourself, he basically was one big mess of competing risk.
Yeah.
Is he going to die of colon cancer, lung disease, or lung cancer first? And how much do we try and prevent one knowing that the other two may still get him?
Although, as you know, obviously, incurable non-small cell and even metastatic colon cancer are not benign diseases.
Just in terms of symptoms.
Well, also in terms of how long it takes for people to die.
Well, that's correct.
Although, I guess I've been hearing from investigators in the age of all the new options now that patients are living longer with metastatic colorectal cancer. You think that's really the case?
I definitely think that's the case.
But are we talking about a year longer or a few years longer?
Well, are you talking about over all the drugs we've developed? Or just
yeah, now compared
year
to 10 years ago.
Well, so here's the evolution in my mind. We actually have data on best supportive care, and we know that the median survival with best supportive care is 6 months. All the time I was in my training, we essentially had 5-FU in some form or another. You know, we had a little leucovorin, do it by infusion, but essentially 10 to 12 months for 5-FU. Adding either Oxali or irinotecan without really tweaking it originally was looking about 15, 16 months. Then we had the Turnagain trial that looked at really good FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, 21 months, and probably something along those lines, maybe a little better with the addition of Bev. So we're approaching 2 years. So in my mind, there's been a fourfold increase in median survival. Or looking at it the other way, I rarely saw patients living much more than a year, and now I see it all the time. So yes, I honestly believe we've made a difference.
And finally, we sneak in a couple of minutes of one of the most fascinating areas of oncology, gastrointestinal stromal tumors, and Dr. Blanky's take that in contrast to colorectal cancer, a lot's happened in the past year with GIST.
So 2008 was actually a fairly good year for GIST researchers, and there are a lot of things that have emerged that are now important for practitioners. Probably the biggest news within the last year is the FDA approval of imatinib following resection of primary GIST. That is based on the ACOSOG Z9001 study that showed a dramatic decrease in recurrences if people take 1 year of postoperative imatinib, and that study directly led to the label. Interestingly, there was a high rate of recurrences about 6 months after people stopped taking drug at 18 months. So even the primary investigator on that trial most likely thinks that 1 year is not sufficient. And interestingly, the FDA label doesn't have a duration. But we're really kind of stuck. We know giving the drug is the correct thing to do. We don't know how long.
Once you get somebody through a year, in general, is it usual that you can keep them going, or some
yes.
people just barely make it?
No, it was actually, that is a very interesting question. Some people did have to go off trial. Of course, that was true in terms of dose reduction, dose delays, even on the placebo arm, which is very interesting to me. But that said, in my experience, once they make it to a year, and this is also borne out from the metastatic literature, they do fine, and they can essentially, in terms of a toxicity standpoint, stay on forever. There are no new toxicities that usually appear down the line.
So what else has happened?
So similarly, the RTOG neoadjuvant trial was published by Bert Eisenberg, and I was an investigator on that trial as well. It basically showed that giving the drug preoperatively is certainly feasible. It's very safe. There used to be some concerns about whether or not there'd be wound healing problems. None of that materialized. It's very difficult to interpret a small phase 2 study, but that study included a population that had resection of metastatic disease. And the recurrence rate at 2 years seemed to be markedly lower with the use of the drug. Now, again, that might just be an adjuvant benefit, not a neoadjuvant benefit. But at least we know we can give it before surgery if we have to. Right now, if I had a potentially resectable GIST patient, I personally would not give them the drug preoperatively. However, if I had somebody who was borderline resectable or they required major organ takedown, I would strongly consider it because we know that a lot of those patients downsize and can have a much easier surgery.
Same in terms of potentially resectable mets, specifically liver mets. Rather just take them out?
Yes, the situation's a little bit more complicated there because it partly depends on whether that's their primary presentation or their second shot at it. We know from markedly older studies that salvage surgery in the absence of tyrosine kinase inhibitors like imatinib never works. Even if it's a chip shot, even if it's a solitary liver met, 5 years later, you could whack it out or RFA it easily. It's always the tip of the iceberg. So in that case, I would certainly not go directly to surgery. I would absolutely and unequivocally use imatinib. If they presented with metastatic disease that was very limited, then I think it's a bit debatable about which approach is correct. And this is actually timeliness between you. I just was asked to write an article about the best of 2008, so I'm glad I just took a peek at it. The question of dose of imatinib in metastatic disease has reared its head again. There was some data from a European phase 3 trial that perhaps exon 9 patients, often those who have tumors arising in a small bowel, do better with a higher dose of imatinib.
Right from the start.
Mostly correct. While it's probably true that they should get it right away, we know that if you go from nothing to 800, about two-thirds of people can't tolerate it. But if you go to 400, ease them into it for a while, then 600 for a week or two, then 800, most people can tolerate it.
So when they can't tolerate it, why?
Nausea, vomiting, blood dyscrasias, rarely more severe toxicities like liver, etc. So it actually fits quite nicely because basically what I do, and I'm basing this now on the fact that Mike Heinrich just published in Journal of Clinical Oncology from our American trial, which also suggested that exon 9 needs a higher dose. What we do is you get a patient with metastatic disease, they obviously need a drug, you put them on imatinib at 400, then you send off their specimen, it might take a couple of weeks to come back, that gives them time to get used to the 400 milligram dose, and then when it comes back as exon 9, then I escalate them to the higher dose.
So every patient with GIST should have that assay?
Yes, and that's a difficult recommendation to make because the testing is not all that easy right this second. In terms of very few centers are doing it. More centers are trying to gear up.
How hard is it to send it out?
It's not. It's easy. And if your listeners are interested, there is actually the Heinrich Corliss website at OHSU. They can just put in a search engine, Heinrich Corliss, OHSU GIST. And it actually has very detailed and very simple instructions. If they want to use that particular lab, of course, they can use a different lab if they choose. But that one's, in my opinion, one of the best.
We'll put that link in the booklet accompanying this program.
That's a great idea.
Any idea what fraction of people with GIST in the United States are getting the test?
Strangely enough, I do. At this very meeting, there was a poster presentation, to be fair, by myself. This is now registry data. So this is what's actually going on in the community and the academic centers, not on a clinical trial basis, but just a strict report of what people are doing. And I was extraordinarily disappointed to see that only about 1% of patients in the community are getting mutational analysis, and it was not any better, really, in the academic centers. It was still low single digits, which is just mind-boggling to me. Maybe it'll change now that Mike's article has been published, but if you want to sort of minimize what you have to do, you might be able to sort of risk stratify by location. I mean, if you have a gastric GIST, it's less likely to be exon 9, but not zero.
So what exactly is the test that you're sending it all for, genomic analysis?
Well, there's two different ways you can do it. If you want to have full exon testing, it can be done. It takes 3 to 4 weeks, and you'll get a lot of interesting information. But if you wind up with a really rare exon mutation or exon 17, while we're learning what drugs are better, there's really no absolutely established paradigm. That said, there is now a rapid exon 9 test that OHSU either will be offering or is offering. It's basically exon 9, yes or no.
And that's what you want to know.
That's all you care about at this point if you're in the trenches. And then the final thing of interest is there has been some data from the B2222 trial, which is one of the longest followed studies in metastatic disease, showing a median survival of about 5 years. A corollary to that study suggested that drug level is very important. And if you had the best type of mutation, exon 11, and you achieved a certain drug level, you basically had no chance of progressive disease. Whereas if you had lower levels, you did have a chance of progression. And basically the implication is it might in the future be worth doing testing for drug levels. And if they're very low, you can either ask your patient about their compliance or assume that for whatever reason they're not absorbing it or they're excreting it and maybe bump up the level. That's not an official recommendation by experts yet. The patient advocacy groups are pushing it a little bit, but there's been no prospective validation of this. However, there is talk of doing a trial to test that strategy, and I think we're going to be seeing it as an established technique within the next year.
What's the current estimate of annual number of cases of GIST in the United States?
I'd say roughly 4,500 or so that are clinically significant GISTs.
And deaths?
That's a great question. They're very unusual still, because people are living for years with a disease on imatinib and now sunitinib and all the others.
So it's kind of a moving target, and we don't.
It's definitely a moving target.
What was it a few years ago with pre-biologic days?
Well, pre-biologics, basically everybody who got the disease died because either you had metastatic disease with a very short median survival, or you had it resected and had a high recurrence rate and then died of it.
Assuming you were accurately diagnosed.
Correct. Remember, as you yourself are hinting at, a lot of those patients were called leiomyomas and leiomyosarcomas. But sort of in the period when I was really getting into this between, say, 97 and 2000, we knew it just were, and we saw our patients dying, all of them.